Well, thank you very much, Michael, and it's always lovely to be with you. And I love being at this church. Like, whenever I come to Kubi, there's just this great sense of worship, and there's this sense of just being in the presence of God, and it feels like coming home. So thank you. Thank you for having invited me more than once, which I never take for granted. And it's great to be here with you today. Now, wherever I go, I always do take, I've written a number of books, and always take them with me in case there's anyone who's interested in them. Two latest ones are Why Christianity is Probably True, it is, you know. It's like when you actually look at the arguments, you can look at the counter-arguments, and the book does, and it tries to take them, well, it does take them seriously, and it acknowledges that there are some things that could make you doubt, but actually when you look at the other side, the argument for God, it's pretty overwhelming, and when you put all the evidence together, you come to the conclusion, yeah, you know what, I think this is probably true. And then, of course, if you dive on in, you discover that it most assuredly is. So it's a great book for, if you doubt in yourself, or if you have people who feel like, I'd love to believe, but I'm not sure if that's reasonable. Now, my very latest book is Stirrers and Saints, and someone who I will remain nameless said to me as I was coming in, well, I identify with one of those words, and it's not the saints one. And that's actually good, because it's good to be a stirrer, and leadership depends on people being stirrers and looking for change and how things can be better. And yet we need to find a way to be the leader that God has called us to be while also being spiritually formed. So this is a book about spiritual formation and growing in your spiritual leadership, and I think that it's something that's really needed today. So if you're interested in either of those books or any of the others that are there, just come and chat to me afterwards. Now, today, we're going to look at one of my favorite passages from the Old Testament. It's a story that quite likely you're familiar with, or if you aren't, you're in for a real treat, because it's an amazing story. It's a story of a burning bush and Moses' encounter with God as he gets called by God to release the Hebrews out of bondage in Egypt. So it's a rallying cry to action. And you know who it comes to? It comes to an 80-year-old. Now, I'm looking around here today. Some of you are probably in that category. Some of you got a few years to go. Basically, the passage is saying, so many people use age as an excuse. Don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. With God, everything's possible. Okay, let me read the passage. Exodus chapter 3 and the first 14 verses. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Incidentally, whenever you read the name Horeb in the Bible, sometimes it is interchanged with the name Sinai. So Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, we're speaking about the same place. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, and just listen to how rich this introduction of God is, because in these verses, God is saying, this is the kind of God I am. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are pressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, And this will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. That is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. Wonderful passage. Hey, let's start with a little bit of Trivial Pursuit. Okay, so 1989. It's 1989. Most of you would have been alive then. And it's the men's French singles tennis champion finals. Who was the winner of that tournament and what was particularly notable about it? So it's the final of the men's, men's one, so no swapping of genders there. It's 1989, finals, French singles open, men's. Who's the winner? Anyone going? Nope, not John McEnroe. It's Michael Chang. And what was notable about it was that Michael Chang is the youngest ever winner of a Grand Slam tournament. And when he won that French Open, he was 17 years and 109 days old. And 17 years, 109 days old. And you know, there's some 17-year-olds and they look like 30-year-olds. And there's some 17-year-olds and they look like 10-year-olds. And Michael Chang was more in the 10-year-old category. Like, he was just this baby-faced, looked like this kid. And if you were watching and if you like want to go back and watch those games, it was so exciting, so extraordinarily exciting, because this kid, essentially, no one thought that he'd win. No one thought that he would get this far. And he went on and won, youngest ever winner of a Grand Slam tournament. But here's the thing. Like, if you were there that day, you would have said, he is going to do the most astonishing things that you could ever imagine. No one has been like this before. Like, here's the new grade of tennis, we know it. 17 years and 109 days, my goodness, so much life ahead of him. He's going to be the most amazing champion. And you would have been sort of right. Because Michael Chang did go on, and he had a very, very good tennis career. He's in the Hall of Fame, and like, I'm certainly not. And he went on to be the 40th, like the 40th largest earner of tennis earnings, you know, which is not bad. Like, I mean, I wouldn't mind being the 1,040th highest earner of earnings in tennis. But for all that, like, if you were there that day when he won that French Open, and then you saw how it turned out, you would have said, oh, I thought that it would be a little bit more than that. Like, I just thought that it would be more. Like, I thought he would be one of, like, he's not the name you think of the whole time when you think of tennis, is it? Like, he's there. If you're a tennis tragic, you certainly know his name. But he's not the person you always think about. And sometimes in life, you look at things that have happened, and you kind of say, so what was that all about? Like, was that significant in any real way? I'm trying to turn this, and it's not changing for me. Great. And you can have a, like, so what was that all about, season in life? And I imagine that if you were Moses at the age of 80, that's what you would have felt about your life. Because when this passage takes place, Moses is 80 years old. And his life had started with such extraordinary promise. Do you remember, he was that baby, there had been this despotic pharaoh, and he had said that all male Hebrew babies who were born needed to be killed, needed to be drowned. And his mother, in a kind of a sort of adherence to that instruction, kind of bypassed it by putting him into the Nile River, but in a basket, so that he floated instead of drowning. And miraculously, he's discovered by Pharaoh's daughter, bobbing along on the Nile, and she takes him into the palace, and he gets raised as a prince. And oh my goodness, the story's even more dramatic, because like when she takes the baby and she thinks, you know, I'm a princess, I can't actually do all the looking after the baby myself, I'll need someone to help. And she turns and finds Moses' mother and says, won't you come and work in the palace and raise this child? And so, like, you just see God's hand in it. And so God is protecting this child. And he gets raised up in the palace, and you know he's set for great things. And then at the age of 40, he goes out one day, and indeed, it's very promising because he's going and he's wanting to see what's happening to his people, the Hebrews. And they're, of course, slaves, and they've been treated abominably badly by the Egyptians. And as he goes to see what's happening to them, it just so happens that he sees a Hebrew slave being beaten up by an Egyptian. Now, we must always be a little bit careful when we look to material that's outside of the Bible, but we do have a tradition around what happens here. And in terms of Jewish tradition, there's very, very ancient writing. It's you don't find in the Bible, but it fills in on what happens, and that's the story. Because according to the tradition, this Egyptian who was beating up this Hebrew slave had just raped the Hebrew slave's wife. And the Hebrew slave had objected to that and had tried to intervene. And because he had tried to intervene, the Egyptian had turned on him and was beating him up. And there was nothing that the Hebrew man could really do because he was a slave and slaves weren't allowed to fight back. And it's Moses comes upon this scene of this extraordinary violation that has taken place. And he just fumes and he's like, he's outraged. And he looks and he says, like, who's around here? No one. Well, this is unacceptable. And he goes in and he kills the Egyptian. And you would have thought at that moment, if you were there and you were thinking, what does God have in store for this man? This is the start of the revolution. This will change everything. Great, perfect timing. Moses is then 40 years of age. And you think this will be the turning of everything. But it isn't. Because news of what's happened gets back to the palace. And Moses has seen to be, my goodness, we brought you into the palace. You're one of our princes. You set for greatness and you turn on us. This is totally unacceptable. Your life is over. And Moses has to flee into the wilderness. And he arrives there at 40 and he gets married and he stays there for the next 40 years. And nothing of serious note seems to take place. In fact, in ever so many ways, it sounds extraordinarily pathetic, doesn't it, when you look at number three. Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. In other words, he's 80 and he doesn't even have his own sheep. Like, he's tending someone else's flock. They aren't his. Like this man who's going to change the whole world and everything, he's working for someone else. And my goodness, he's 80 and he's still working. He's not even on a pension yet. Like, what happened to that? I mean, what was that all about? And if you were there, you would think, talk about the loss of dreams. Talk about underrealized potential. Talk about things that just didn't happen. Except that that's the moment that God comes and intervenes. And that's the astonishing thing. And I think that this is one of our favorite passages, one of my favorite passages, because it keeps on coming back and says to us, when you think that everything is lost, think again. When you think that you've got to give up on your dream, think again. When you think that it's too late, think again. Because it could be that on a very ordinary day, you're walking along, and as you're walking on ground that you've walked on so often before, suddenly it becomes holy ground. Now, how can ordinary ground become holy ground? Well, it's holy because sometimes God's presence just comes in a remarkable way. And it's fascinating, isn't it, what God tells Moses to do. He calls out to Moses, 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 like, don't come any nearer. Like, the land, the ground that you're on is holy ground. So take your sandals off. Beg your pardon? Like, I mean, whenever you read scripture, be a little bit curious and be a little bit cheeky and ask some questions. And you say, and be willing to say, that doesn't make sense to me. Because to take my sandals off doesn't make sense to me because you're telling me this ground is so holy that I must take my sandals off. But I'm sorry, my feet aren't particularly clean and my feet are like the grubby part of me and my sandals help to keep them a little bit cleaner. So surely I should keep my sandals on when I walk on holy ground because I don't want my grubby feet walking on this special place. Yeah, okay, that's one way you could think about it. But I think that God is saying something quite different, isn't he? He's saying, because this is holy ground, do not let anything come between you and God. And your sandals, like thin and inconsequential though they might be, they're a barrier between experiencing what actually is. So take them off. Don't be afraid. Like, if you're going to be a part of the experience, be fully part of this experience. You are on holy ground and enter into it fully. And I think that that's got something to say to us. Because sometimes when we sense that God is close, we feel embarrassed or awkward or whatever, and we grab onto our sandals and we put on our overcoat and we put up the barriers, and God is saying, no, enter fully into what I'm inviting you into. And as this encounter begins, let's remember this is an encounter with Moses. So if you're a little bit of a biblical scholar, and I were to ask you this question, like, who was the most influential person in helping us to know about God in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible? The most reasonable answer to give to that question, I think, would be Moses. Moses is the driving force behind the writing of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. He's the one who gives us the Ten Commandments. He's the one who helps us to really understand what God is like. I mean, we're in Exodus here now, so it's the second book of the Bible, and we're getting into kind of finding out what God is like. And remember, the Bible is a book of progressive revelation of God. So it's quite early on in the revelation. We haven't learned that much. But Moses is going to be teaching us all kinds of things about God. And the extraordinary thing is that at this stage, Moses himself knows very little about God. I mean, you find out, for example, that God calls to Moses and says, Moses, Moses. But later on, Moses has to say to God, well, very impressive that you know my name. I don't know your name. Like, who are you, actually? Like, you know me. I don't know you. How am I going to tell people about you? Who's sending me? I don't even know what's going on here. And so as God brings his introduction to Moses, remember, it comes to Moses, who will be passing this information on to others, but himself doesn't know terribly much about God at this point in time. And to this Moses, God introduces with these words. Verse 7, the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. And if we could just have the slide turn on again. I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians. So could we just have the next slide? There we go. Perfect. So as you go through, what is this passage saying to us about God? Like, this God that we don't actually know. It's saying, I am the God who sees. I am the God who hears. I am the God who is concerned. And therefore, I am the God who comes to you. Now, if you don't know anything about God, those are very significant things to say, because God's first thing says, I have seen. I see what is happening. I see you. I mean, you want to tell people the kind of God I am. I'm not the God who is remote and at a huge distance. I'm the God who actually sees what is going on. But notice, it doesn't just stop at that. It says, I have seen and I have heard. And it's really important to have both of those together, because it is perfectly possible to see something that is happening and to completely misinterpret it. Now, let me give you a silly example. So, yeah, I write a number of books, and I write in the kind of non-fiction category. But when I read fiction, I love to read murder mysteries. How many murder mystery fan readers are there? Who are your trash? Good, great. You are my people. So one of the great genres, like, if you ever read a murder mystery, you know that the author has to deceive you in multiple ways, because there's got to be a suspense and there's got to be a surprise element. And what they quite often do, one of the techniques of the genre, is to tell you something that's true at a certain level, but that you are going to misinterpret. And you'll often misinterpret it because you simply are told of something that you could see. So in at least five murder mysteries that I've read, this scenario has taken place. There is a woman who is the corpse, because there's always a corpse in murder mysteries. So the corpse is a middle-aged woman. And so whenever there's a corpse, you have to investigate why someone wanted to get this person to be a corpse. And, you know, things unfold progressively. But quite often, the corpse starts out as this extraordinary saint who everyone thinks is wonderful and marvelous, and no one can understand why they would possibly be killed, and it's terrible and it's tragic and everything. And then you're told, oh my goodness, someone saw her at a restaurant. And she, this middle-aged woman, was talking to a very handsome young man. And they looked as though they were very, like she looked adoring the atom. And they, oh my goodness, the slut. Like, there she was. We thought that she was the pillar of respectability, but she's obviously having this terrible affair with this young man. Like, who would have thought? And you are led to think that. But if you had actually heard what was going on with that conversation, and this gets revealed much later on once they've confused you completely, you would have heard that actually this woman, rather than being romantically drawn to the young man, was speaking to her son, and that she had had him when she was 16 years old. It was a tragic event, and she'd had to give him up for adoption, and he's been searching everywhere, and he's now refound his mother, and she's come back into his life. And like, this is an adoring conversation, but it's not what you thought it was. And so, cling, 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 and like when you get that piece of information, then you start to see everything in a different way. Now why am I wanting to labor the point? I'm wanting to labor the point because we can often see things and jump to completely wrong conclusions. And this passage is saying to us, this is a God who not only sees, but who then draws near and says, so tell me about it. What is it that I hear? And he listens to the story. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. This is no Deus Remotus, no God who just removes himself from everything. This is a God who sees, I have seen, I have heard. And then there's a third step. And I am concerned. This is a God who feels. Like, I see how terrible this is for you. I have listened to it. I'm starting to really understand it. And this doesn't leave me cold. I am concerned. And what's more, because of that, I'm not only concerned, but what? So I have come to you. Like, put those four words together, and it tells you so much about God. Like, I'm the God who sees, who listens to you, who is concerned about what is happening, and who therefore comes to you. Now, in this particular passage, it is, of course, quite fascinating that when God says, so I have come, he's actually saying that to Moses, and he's saying, Moses, listen, I've come to the people, but by the way, you're part of the plan. Like, this is the way that the people are going to most know that I've come to them, because you are going to be the person who's going to lead them out of bondage. You're the person I've chosen. And it's the starting reminder that this God of the universe who sees and who hears and who is concerned and who comes to us, that this God calls us and says, yes, I'm coming, and it's through you that I'm coming. I'm wanting to actually use you. And of course, sometimes we get uncomfortable at that point, and Moses also got pretty uncomfortable at that point, because as he thought about that, he kind of realized that he was afraid. I mean, he had been that route before, and maybe we could just have the next slide there. And he'd been that route before, and it finished just so badly. And so he starts to make his excuses to God. And he starts to say, so God, you want to use me? No. Like, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and say, you know, the people have got to be set free? And then he says, and anyway, I don't even know who you are. Like, when people say, who has sent me to you? I mean, this is so haunting, isn't it? Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites. Suppose I go. Like, just imagine for a moment that I obey you and do what you suggest. Like, they just hypothesize about that. It's probably not going to happen. Let's be very clear about it. But let's just suppose that I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? What shall I tell them? I don't have no idea. This is a bizarre encounter. Like, here's this bush, and it's on fire. It's been burnt up, but it's not been burnt up. It's remarkable. And you're talking to me from this bush. And like, I'm sorry, I can't just go to Pharaoh on the basis of this. Who are you? What is your name? What shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. Now, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't have found that particularly helpful. What? I am who I am has sent me to you. So, who sent me to you? I am who I am has sent me to you. What's what's that? And as Michael said, I was principal of the theological college for many years. And there have been literally hundreds of PhD theses exploring what that means. And everyone disputes it, and everyone tries to interpret it in a different way. And it's very, very hard to say what that name means. But of all the different views that I've read in my time, and I've read a fair few, I have found the view of Adria Koenig, who's a South African theologian, the most convincing. He looks at it and he analyzes the Hebrew, and he points out that the structure is verbal. In other words, this is about doing, this is about action. And he says the best way to interpret I am who I am is God is saying, my name is something is going to happen. My name is something is going to happen. I am being, I am the one who exists, and I am doing something, and because I am everything that is, nothing will be quite the same again. I am has sent you, something is going to happen. And when they say, who has sent you, tell them, something is going to happen. Now Moses, as we didn't read this part of the passage, but you can read it for yourself. Moses is not entirely impressed by that. And he says, yeah, I'll need more than that, thank you. Like please, I can't just manage with that. Like, give me something more. And God says to him, so, okay, what's in your hand? And he says, a staff. And he says, throw it to the ground. And so Moses does that. And, oh my goodness, it becomes a snake. And Moses, God says, pick it up. And Moses, a bit hesitant, like, I can understand that. But picks it up and it becomes a staff all over again. And what's happening in that scenario? God is saying to him, listen, something is going to happen because I've sent you. And you may think that you have nothing to offer, but what's in your hand? Like whatever's in your hand. And it wasn't because it was a staff. If he had had a handkerchief in his hand, God would have said, throw the handkerchief to the ground. Or if he had had a morrow bar, throw the morrow bar to the ground. Like the point wasn't that it was a staff. God was wanting to say to him, whatever you have, I can use, and I can transform it, and it will be more than enough, more than enough. Because I am has sent me, and because something is going to happen. Now, I think that what it's saying to us is, like, when God comes and meets with us, don't be too quick to assume that you know what's going to happen, because God is remarkable. And when he sees and when he hears, and because he doesn't respond as we sometimes do, I mean, we sometimes see and we sometimes hear and we go, whatever, so sad, too bad. But no, God is concerned. But God is concerned not just in a way that says, I think that's terrible, but oh, poor me, I can't. No, I have come and I'm using you and I'm sending you. And something is going to happen. So don't assume because you're 80. And don't assume because everything has been underwhelming until now. Don't assume that nothing's going to happen. Because I'm the God who makes all the difference. It was 2002. I was pastor of Mount Roskill Baptist Church in Auckland, New Zealand. I was very happy there, but I'd been approached by a large theological seminary in the US about coming and teaching there and being on their staff. And it'd been really quite exciting. I got quite excited and thought the family was going to move to the U.S., and it was great. And we were in negotiations, and as suddenly as it arose, boom, it just changed. And no, not going to happen. And I felt very disappointed with that, because I'd got really quite excited about that option. And I was seeing my spiritual director, because I used to go to a spiritual director quite often and found that very helpful. And we spoke it through, and that was good. And I can remember going back after that session with the spiritual director, going into my study at home, and I felt this overwhelming sense of joy coming over me. And I felt as though God was there, and God was saying, I'm with you. And as God said that to me, I remember saying, thank you so much that you've put me here at Mount Roskill. Thank you that I'm the senior pastor of this wonderful church with these wonderful people, this wonderful city, and this wonderful place. I'm really delighted to be here. Like, I thought I was going to go to the U.S., and I accept it's not, and this is my place, and I will be retiring from here one day, and I'm delighted, and I'm joyful, and I'm so pleased about that. And I felt as though I felt the most enormous sense of joy as I accepted that as being God's will. And as I said that, I heard God say to me in the clearest ways, don't be so sure that you know what the future holds. Don't be so sure that you know what the future holds. And it was literally just a few weeks after that that I was approached by Baptist Churches in Western Australia to come and be the principal of what was then Baptist Theological College, then Vaux Seminary, now part of Morning College. My life just turned completely upside down. Like, don't be so sure that you know what the future holds. That's what this passage is about. It's about an 80-year-old Moses going about his usual work, which was looking after someone else's sheep. Woo-hoo. And as he did that work, suddenly, ordinary ground became holy ground. And the God who he didn't know until that point came and said, this is the kind of God I am. I'm the God who sees and who hears and is concerned and who comes to you. I am who I am because something is going to happen and I'm calling you and I'm listening to your pathetic excuses and I'm not vaguely impressed. Like, so take what you have in your hand and just get over yourself because something is going to happen because I see and I hear and I'm concerned and I'm coming and I'm going to do something. And it could be that with dreams that you have given up on, God is saying, don't be too quick to let them go. And yeah, they may work their way out in a very different way, but something always happens when God is at work. Let's pray. And thank you, Lord, that on this wet, windy day that you are here, the God of the universe, and you see us. And thank you, God, that you knew Moses' name even though Moses didn't know your name. And Lord, for some of us, you know our name, though we don't know yours. Please make yourself more real to us. Draw close to us. Thank you that we can know you because you've even sent your son, Jesus. We thank you for that. Well, Jesus, some of us are struggling with dreams that haven't happened. We don't know what to make of them, and we wonder what that was all about. Come restore hope. Lord, we know that something's going to happen. It might be something that just changes us inwardly. Maybe something tangible. Something outward. Lord, whatever, we thank you that your name is that something is going to happen. And we trust you. Amen.